good evening. You are listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Of course, our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We're on satellite across North America on virtual channel W3957 on kickitradio.com. And, of course, Access Communications, channel 7. That's on TV. Tonight on the Dana Pretzer Show from Let's Bring Them Home, LaDonna Meredith. Please go to their webpage at www.letsbringthemhome.org. We're going to talk about that organization and some of the missing people that they're trying to find. Then after that, Carmen Mercer will be here. She's the Vice President of the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps. Of course, we're going to talk about the Bush administration missing the deadline for the promised first 70 miles of the physical border between Mexico and the United States. After that, Wendy Murphy, the former DA, law professor, and author of the new book, And Justice for Some, will be here. We're going to talk about a strange case that happened where a mother used a Q-tip that she used to clean her meth pipe on her child, and the child died. It's pretty sad. Of course, I want you to go to Wendy's webpage for her book, andjusticeforsome.com. Then we're going to get right into the dog fighting segment here that we haven't spoken to anyone from the Humane Society of the United States for a while. Lori Maxwell will be here. She is the deputy manager for animal fighting issues with the Humane Society of the United States. We're going to talk about that serious thing called dog fighting. That's tonight here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Glad to have you, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. It's nice to have this guest on with me now and then, LaDonna Meredith from letsbringthemhome.org. I want you to go check out their webpage right away. Letsbringthemhome.org is here tonight to talk about Let's Bring Them Home and a press release that they put out here the other day that deals with the disappearance of Clinton Nelson. It's been 1 year since Clinton disappeared, and I thought I'd bring LaDonna on to talk about that case. Others and what Let's Bring Them Home is all about. Hi, LaDonna. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's nice to have you on the program. Before we get into some of the cases, and in particular the Clinton Nelson case, let's talk about letsbringthemhome.org and fill in those on my show who may not know what that's all about.
Well, I'd be glad to. Let's Bring Them Home is a national nonprofit organization, and our focus is to act as an advocacy group for families with missing adults or children. And what we do is we offer public relations services to these families on a national scope that allows the family a second resource where they might not otherwise have one, as far as being able to get their case back into the media.
And that's a big part of any missing person case, is the exposure to the media and getting people to know, because without that exposure and people knowing what's going on, it's a little hard to find someone, is it not?
Well, I mean, I would say it's next to impossible, because what you find when you get into these cases, and then just looking at the way our society is as a whole, is that society is hungry, thirsty for what the media constantly fills them, and it's usually a bunch of nonsense. You watch countless hours of information about Paris Hilton or Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the truth?
Oh, it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Makes you sick.
And we allow our children and our young adults to be compromised in a sense that they are continually watching, you know, violent films or just wasteful. And so what you don't see is the media filling the heads of the public with what's important. And that's one of the focuses of our organization. Every missing person is important, and they should have just as much coverage as the frivolous things in this world, such as the Lindsay Lohans. And it just incenses us that that's not happening on a regular basis. So that's one of our efforts, is to bring these cases to the forefront.
There's a big difference between local exposure, which is important, but national exposure with today's cable television outlets, the internet, you name it, it's important to get right out there. How difficult is it to get a missing persons case, say, on Fox News, for example?
It's fairly difficult. We do have some contacts with Fox News, and they've been great to work with. But you have to also understand that, you know, there's 2,300 people that go missing on a daily basis, according to statistics. And so it's tough. You're out there having to fight the good fight for these families, and the media more and more wants the sensational cases. They want the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, six-year-old girls that have been kidnapped from their bedrooms.
Right.
And they're not really, they're exploiting a problem that is true and that happens. Those abductions are rare, but they do happen, but those scenarios are being exploited by the media. And so it makes it even more difficult to pitch a story to the media when the case seems rather dull and not quite as sensationalized. But we all know that the cases aren't dull. They're all important.
And exactly. And we're not making light of any missing blonde-haired, blue-eyed, six-year-old girls. It's the fact of the media looking at if it bleeds, it leads, and sensationalizing things that becomes very difficult. Now, when a family comes to you or you want to try and help a family, what's the first step? What do they do when they come to you, or what do you do when you try to get the ball rolling, so to speak?
Well, our services have to be requested by law enforcement or the searching family. So there has to have been a police report filed. And so basically when the family or law enforcement comes to us or we come across this case, to get the ball rolling, we have to have a copy of the police report. And then we immediately assess what media coverage has happened, what went right, what went wrong, and what are some angles to the story that perhaps the media hadn't considered. We work with law enforcement in all of our cases to make sure what we're doing is acceptable to them and not compromising to the case, because we have to work with law enforcement. We need to be a tool for law enforcement.
It's unfortunate sometimes with law enforcement, I'm not going to say jealousy, but sometimes there's a competitive edge between law enforcement agencies and searchers or nonprofit organizations as far as sharing information and doing what's right. Have you run into those types of problems, or has it been fairly smooth riding for you?
Well, we've seen a little bit of both. I think for some law enforcement, until they get to know us or understand the value of what our organization offers, they've been skeptical. But once they've worked with us, so far, we've been embraced by law enforcement in about 22 states, and we see that rapidly growing because we really do bring value to the case, and we do assist law enforcement, which is different than what a lot of other organizations do. You know, we definitely want to make the public understand that law enforcement has a really tough job, and we're definitely not trying to be, sleuths on our own and try to help solve the case necessarily. We're trying to help bring it to the forefront so those tips will come forward. So today it's been very successful. We've had two recoveries, and so we feel good about that.
Let's talk about those two recoveries, and then we'll get into some more cases.
Well, one had a happy ending. It's the case of a 17-year-old runaway out of Independence, Missouri. She was a habitual runaway, and law enforcement really couldn't do a lot for the family. They took the report, but, you know, they'd repeatedly gone after this young woman, and at this point it was beyond their resources. They suggested to the family that they contact Let's Bring Them Home, our organization, and we got involved immediately from day one. The media wouldn't work with the family because of her habitual runaway status, and within a week of the work that we did and the flyer distribution and the press releases, she read about herself in the newspaper and called home.
Wow. And that's got to be a good feeling to have something like that happen. And the habitual runaway, I hate that term, because a runaway is also a missing person. And how do you tell a family that someone has run away when really they're so panicked and they're wanting to find out answers?
Well, it's a terrible thing, and it's a terrible term. And, you know, what we try to also do is offer resources to the family that can address why this child habitually runs away. You know, what can we do to help? So we don't just end our services at, well, the child has been returned home or called home. We continue to check in and help address those issues. And I think that's one of the things that makes us unique, is that in addition to the public relations resources that we also offer the development of safety programs when appropriate in individual cities and states, and we also offer education initiatives. And one of the things that we do offer is runaway information and runaway prevention education, and so we have found that that's been a valuable tool.
If you're just tuning in tonight, LaDonna Meredith from letsbringthemhome.org is with us, and we're talking about that organization and some of the cases that they are focusing on. One of the cases that has come up, it's been 1 year since Clinton Nelson went missing. Let's talk about that. He was last seen Friday, September 1st, 2006, leaving a friend's house in the vicinity of Ward Lane and Highway 80 in Princeton, Louisiana. Let's talk about that case, LaDonna.
You know, it's one of those cases that I wake up in the morning thinking about, and I go to bed at night thinking about it. It's a case that should be fairly open and shut. You know, he was last seen at this friend's residence at the vicinity of Warren Lane and Highway 80. And we know that someone at that party, probably the owners of the house, they know what happened to Clinton. But nobody is talking, and we have a great relationship with law enforcement there, and they'll be the first to tell you that since we've gotten involved, we've been able to really stir up new leads in the case through our press conferences and through the tip line that we've offered. But the sad thing is, like you see in hundreds of cases, the people who know what happened to Clinton aren't coming forward because they risk going to prison for what they did to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And that's the tough part in any of these cases is trying to get somebody to talk.
It is, and so we continue to look at new angles in the case as far as what we can do as an organization. One of the things that we offer are rewards. We offer a toll-free tip line. We do mass mail-outs in the area the person was last seen. And we get out and we hit the streets as a team and we distribute flyers. And three of us went to Shreveport, one of us being Clinton Nelson's mother, Carolyn Johnson,
right.
And we distributed hundreds of flyers, and that helped stir up the case again. So we know that we're putting pressure on the people that have information, and we will continue to do so fairly heavily through the end of December of 2007 in hopes that someone will, you know, crack and come forward.
You know, some of these cases aren't just a few days, a few weeks, a few months. They're a few years old. And Mara, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Murray, is one of those. She disappeared Monday, February 9th, 2004 at approximately 7:30 p.m. following a minor car accident on Route 112 near Woodsville, New Hampshire. Let's talk a little bit about that case. That's another one that's on the letsbringthemhome.org website.
You know, Mara Murray's case just baffles me. It's one of those things that tugs on my heartstrings and strikes fear in my heart because I'm a relatively young woman. My friends are relatively young women, and we travel alone. And one of the things that I tell people is that could have been any of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost like Mara just fell off the face of the earth. I mean, it's just the most heart-wrenching case. We are offering a fairly large reward in her case for information. And when we first launched the reward, the tips came rolling in, but it was nothing new. It's nothing that's led us to the whereabouts of Mara. We are committed to turning up the heat on that case. We're looking at a trip to that area to get out there and hit the streets. That's something that we haven't done yet. And we're looking at new avenues to continue to turn up the pressure in that case. I know, without a doubt, that there is somebody in that area that knows what happened to Mara, and they just have to have the courage to come forward. I believe that this case could be solved. It's just almost similar to Clinton's. I believe the people that do have the information are the people who are responsible for the crime.
Another case that I have covered here on the program is the April Beth Pitzer case, and that's one that you have on your website. Let's remind the listeners a little bit about April Beth Pitzer.
April Beth Pitzer is missing out of Newberry Springs, California. Another heartbreaking case. She has left behind two young children. Belongings of hers were found in the desert. By all accounts, April's family will tell you as well, law enforcement, that it is believed that April is deceased. But we took on the case knowing that full well, simply because we want to help the family recover what they can, if they can. But we also want to help build a legacy in honor of April you know, it's one of those cases that we've been very touched by. And so we've started a program, an offshoot of what we do, called April's Hope, found at aprilshope.org. And through that initiative, we're helping to raise much-needed funds for search and rescue equipment across the United States. And we know that possibly had they had the right equipment in the beginning, that possibly April would have been recovered. You can never say 100% for sure. And so that's something that we're real dedicated to. April's mother, Gloria, lives right here in Arkansas, and she's been instrumental in a lot of the progress that we've made over the last year.
Organizations like yours and Texas Equisearch and others are funded, you know, through donations and other ways, and it's mind-baffling with the amount of missing persons cases that are there across North America that governments aren't doing more to help fund organizations like yours and Texas Equisearch to help find these people and, like you say, get the equipment out there to help find them. Yes, they may be deceased, but that family still deserves answers. Let's talk about government involvement and them helping with you in our last few minutes here.
You know, government involvement is a hard thing to monitor as far as an organization like ours. There are a lot of different grants out there that are offered by the government. They're just really hard to obtain, and it's not something that we've ruled out, but the funding for what we do, it doesn't exist. And it's difficult because the truth of the matter is that people do not want to give their dollars they're going to donate to a charity to something like this, to an organization that is looking to serve the families of missing loved ones. It's not that they don't care. They just believe it's never going to affect them.
Yeah, and boy, can they find out fast how quick it can affect
them. Well, absolutely they can. So we are striving to change that mindset. And one of the things on a national level, you know, trying to make the government aware, state governments aware, and just the public at large aware, is that we also, the nation has employed safety development programs that affect children and young adults and adults all across the board. And we think that if we can get people excited about our prevention methods just as much as our retroactive methods in these cases, that people will want to give their money. And we're finding that's the truth. We had a very successful fundraiser here in Arkansas not long ago, and we're going to continue to do those types of things. And we're also going to continue to be a voice saying, hey, we need funding. We need help from the government. And so do dozens of other organizations just like ours.
Absolutely. LaDonna Meredith from letsbringthemhome.org. I will have you back on the show soon, and we will follow up with your organization that is only doing good for those that need help. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
We'll stay in touch. Bye-bye. That's the one of the organizers of letsbringthemhome.org, LaDonna Meredith. This is the Dan Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in a minute with Carmen Mercer, the Vice President of the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, and we'll talk about border security. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Carmen Mercer is the Vice President of the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps. She is a 51-year-old legal immigrant from Germany and a proud citizen of the United States of America since 1999. Miss Mercer is also part of the Granny Brigade, grandmothers and mothers who have joined together to protect their children from drugs, disease, violence, and those coming through our borders that shouldn't be. She was a founding member of the Minutemen Corps, established in October 2005. The Bush administration is still missing the deadline for the promised first 70 miles of the physical border. I've had Carmen on the show, El Garza. We've talked border security both from the north and the south perspective many times, and I thought I'd bring Carmen back on the air to talk about it. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, Dana. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's nice to have you back on the program. Border security is still as important of a discussion topic as it always has been, and thank you for coming back on the program. There seems to have been a bunch of open promises, a bunch of rhetoric, a bunch of discussion that has basically led nowhere, and here it seems like only your organization are the only ones that are fighting for securing the borders. Tell us what's going on.
That's absolutely true, Dana, and be amazed that I can tell you right now, I'm right here at our thing. The rumor that the government is also starting to build a security fence a few miles down the road from ours, and of course I had to go down there to check it out, and lo and behold, it's actually. And the great part is the same model that we're using. It looks like it is a security fence just ours. It seems like it's almost high, and it's also using a mesh panel, and it's also using a steel post in the ground, and it looks like it's put into concrete, so you cannot dig underneath it either. So it's absolutely I would have thought it was going to happen, but it seems like things are beginning to materialize.
That's good. I don't know if you can get into a little bit better zone with your phone. It's cutting in and out a little bit. It's okay. We can hear you, but if you can maybe move around a little bit to get a better signal, I'd appreciate that. If this is true, if it's what's happening is actually true, do you see this, and I'm speculating a little bit and I shouldn't be doing that, but do you see this as a result of the good work and pressure you guys have been doing? That's what I see. Or is this a little bit more of a way to compensate for the election that's coming up here pretty quick, and a lot of discussion and a lot of concern from people both in the United States and across North America about border security?
I think it's a combination of things, Dana. I certainly feel that because of the tenacity and the not giving up of the Minimum Civil Defense Corps, I mean, we've been at this for almost 6 years. And we certainly, with the great American public, our 9,000 active volunteers, we've accomplished so much. We've accomplished to defeat the immigration reform bill. And, of course, it was with millions of great American patriots who got involved and who did the faxing and the emailing and the phone calls. And I was, of course, in D.C., and I watched it all and observed it all, and I reported it. It also has to do with the election, because every candidate knows that that is going to be the top priority on the agenda, security. We know that Al-Qaeda is planning another attack, and we certainly, I mean, it seems like now everybody is getting it, that we need to secure that border. And, of course, what better way than to build that fence?
Hearing Chertoff interviewed on Fox News today and asked the question about Al-Qaeda and another attack on the United States, his response was somewhat confusing to me. He responded that he didn't consider to be an illegal that came across the border illegally that would be planning this, rather than someone who has forged their way into the country legally, or making it appear to be legal, and then attacking in that route. Again, more rhetoric. Some of the news reports I've seen, Carmen, that $1.9 billion was appropriated for the fence construction, as well as compensation for 6,000 National Guard troops. But I'm hearing that the National Guard troops are starting to disappear.
Yes, they're actually supposed to be taken out by the end of the summer of next year. And we certainly still need them, but maybe that's why the government is starting to build the fence, because they're realizing, you know, if we take the National Guard out, we have to replace them with something. And, of course, the fence will be a great idea. And we certainly are hoping that it was not only an empty promise, and that we're going to be seeing that fence quite a bit on the southern border. And we certainly are seeing it here on our NACO line, and I'm totally amazed. I'm thrilled, actually. That's what we've been wanting all along. And I've been listening to Mr. Chertoff several times, and I say this, Dana: if the head of Homeland Security is coming out to let us know that we're going to have another Al Qaeda attack, you know it's going to happen.
Right.
For years, they tried to tell us that we have secured the border; we don't have to worry about anything. And we know that people from Arabian countries are coming through our porous borders. We've seen it in our California group. We've seen it in the other organizations as well. So it's definitely happening. I don't think that there are people who have come into the country legally who are going to be attacking our country again. It could quite well be that they have entered the country illegally.
Well, exactly. And regardless, the porous border is a big problem, and we have to wonder just how many have crossed when we can talk about that, Carmen, we must talk about the customs agents, how overworked, underpaid they are, Campion and Ramos, that we've covered on my program several times. We haven't heard much about their case lately. Can you update us as far as what's going on with them?
Yes, one of them was actually moved to Phoenix, and we're actually having a big fundraiser this coming weekend in Phoenix for Compion and Ramos, and we certainly believe that they are going to be pardoned sooner or later. It has to happen. The input of the American people is just there, and the pressure is there, and so I think eventually it won't be too long anymore, and they will be freed. And of course, you know, I've met both of the wives of the agents on several occasions, and they're great individuals, and we're just praying with them and for their husbands that they're going to be released pretty soon.
Overzealous district attorneys that file charges against those that are trying to protect the border frivolously, and I'm saying that term, not you, when the evidence was so overwhelming that this was a drug dealer with $1 million worth of marijuana coming in, it just boggles the mind that... press hasn't covered it much lately, but it's still very important. And the customs agents, Carmen, that are down there working very hard along with you guys are just not funded and just not protected the way they should be. They're under attack every day, are they not?
Absolutely. And a lot of that does not make the media, Dana. As you know, we have quite a few agents that are really getting hurt, literally being shot at constantly. Rocks being thrown at them, and they're doing an awesome job. They're doing the best job they can do with the few means that they do have. And yes, they're overworked and probably underpaid. I agree with you there. And it's amazing, you know, with what happened to Compion and Ramos, that they're still upholding the American Constitution and are still fighting for this country. And it's awesome. And I think for that reason alone, we have to free those two agents, because we know the drug dealer who had come across. His mother claims that he would never leave the house without a gun. And usually when there's a drug deal coming, going down, there's always weapons involved, you know, and that's why even we, as the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, we give the option to our volunteers that they are allowed to carry. Of course, Arizona is a open carry state, and I certainly don't go on the border without my protection. And, you know, we never know what can happen, and we certainly know what happens to our Border Patrol agents. And we would hate to have that happen to anybody. I mean, not only to our agents, but certainly also not to any of our volunteers who are coming out there, you know, with their patriotism to want to secure the border out of the goodness of their heart, you know. And we certainly would hate for them to get hurt.
Yeah, and protecting patriots like yourself should be a number one cause for concern. The sanctuary cities that we hear about all the time, there has been some pressure put on them by the federal government. Bill O'Reilly, for example, on his program has worked to expose some of these sanctuary cities. However, we don't see a lot of it in the other liberal media. That is a huge concern, that cities and mayors are protecting illegals. And I think today, or was it yesterday, that a judge halted letters being sent out to employers of illegals. I don't understand why, when the government can check on social security numbers and advise businesses, listen, you have to make sure that your employees are legitimate before you hire them. What's wrong with that? And what's wrong with the country when these sorts of things happen? And does it take a Bill O'Reilly or myself or you guys to expose this? What's going on?
Well, whatever it takes, that's the avenue we have to take. And there is no law for a sanctuary city. They just are not allowed, actually. It's against the law. And see, though, Dana, for instance, in Arizona, the governor of Arizona, Napolitano, has signed a bill that we will now start punishing the employers who are willfully hiring illegal aliens. And that bill is going to enter effect the beginning of the new year. And already we're seeing a difference. We're seeing that many of the illegals know that their time has come, that they will not be getting a job anymore. And many of them are already now taking that chance, and they're leaving, going into different areas. And it's going to be happening everywhere. Every state, you see it in the legislature, you see it in small city government, And that's why we also have created so many internal chapters with the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, because we're getting involved in the city council and so forth. And so that's where we're going to make the difference.
So not only is this a national initiative, it's right down to the bare-bones city councils, the local police chief, the local sheriff, everyone involved, and this isn't just the United States, across North America to secure the borders, because securing our borders is securing our future, and that's the important thing. Carmen, what's next for you? I know you must not get much sleep.
No, I don't. This is an important issue. And, you know, it's kind of like my life passion, I guess. These last 6 years have been a lifeline for me already. It seems like I haven't done anything else ever in my life, but it's so important. I have 5 grandchildren whom I want to see grow up safe with a quality of life, and we certainly won't give up until this country is secured. It has to happen that way.
How's Minuteman Radio going?
Minuteman Radio is going well, and I see that you are on a different radio station now, am I correct?
Well, I'm on all sorts of different stations. Whoever picks me up can certainly have me.
Oh, okay. Well, has Chris ever contacted you?
No, I haven't talked to him, but he can contact me anytime he likes.
Okay, then I will nudge him again.
My support for you guys is undaunting, for sure. Carmen, sure. Thanks for coming on, and we'll stay in touch. And maybe now that fence is being built, you've seen it, that's good news for now and the future.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dana, for having me.
Okay, Carmen. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's Carmen Mercer, and we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show with Wendy Murphy. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. There's a very strange and tragic story that's out there right now on Fox News has covered it and others, about a California baby that died after her mother, or his mother, I'm not sure, his mother, I'm sorry, used a meth pipe swab to clean his nose. Now, we're hearing about all these strange cases. There was an exorcism case here not that long ago. Just stuff that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I thought I would bring on Wendy Murphy. Wendy's a former DA, law professor, author of a new book, And Justice for Some. And I want you to go to her webpage, andjusticeforsome.com, to talk about these types of cases, sadly, that we see more and more now, and how, from the prosecutor's perspective and from the children's advocate victims' rights perspective that Wendy is very heavily involved in, what she thinks about this. It's mind-boggling. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Dana. Good to be here.
Nice to have you back on the show. You've seen this story. It's just totally bizarre. It's so sad. Is this something where society is failing, or is just something that we're hearing about more now in the news more than ever? And how do you handle these types of cases?
I think the answer to the first question is both.
Right.
All of the above and then some. You know, the fact is we didn't talk nearly enough about the horrible things that happened to kids when I was first a prosecutor 20 years ago. And the explanation for that includes that we don't care enough about kids, because they don't vote, they don't have any money, you know, they can't really wield a lot of power, and so it's easy to ignore them. And frankly, the other part of that is a lot of the bad stuff that happens to kids happens behind closed doors, because they're not out in the real world where traditional policing activity can better protect them, because we can see them. You know, when bad stuff happens in private homes, it's virtually impossible for traditional police style of law enforcement to work. And so we depend on kids to report to outside authorities, and they don't do that very well. And when you talk about very little kids, boy, you know, talk about vulnerable. They can't even speak.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to prove these sorts of cases. And so the nature of the beast is part of the problem. The better... You know, we are doing better, and the good news is that the public is so disgusted when we hear of even one story like this mother with the meth in the swabs. I mean, not only does that suggest that this is a disturbed parent who had no business giving birth, much less taking a child home,
right,
and being allowed to raise a child in isolation, but it really raises questions about what we should be doing better to literally inject more of our community standards and our community awareness. And that includes things like law enforcement literally butting into families and family homes in a way that might otherwise make us uncomfortable. I mean, we all think about our homes as being private places. We don't want the government knocking down our doors, and I respect that too. But if we're going to have kids dropping dead or suffering these horrible fates because we're afraid of violating the privacy rights of parents, then, you know, I think we're making the wrong value choice. So, and we also just frankly need to empower kids a little bit more with the ability to speak out, and we need to believe them more. That doesn't mean everything a kid says is always truthful, and we need to, you know, lock up all parents anytime a child says anything. You know, we have to be careful about due process. But the bottom line is, kids are so vulnerable. And for me, when I think about vulnerabilities, I'm always in the mindset, this is a purely philosophical or, you know, moral debate, but when I think about a super vulnerable population, I want us to be extra powerful when it comes to community and even law enforcement resources to account for the fact that kids can't protect themselves.
Medical facilities and medical administrators that are worried about the privacy rights. I'm just looking more at this story. The baby, 8-month-old baby Samuel Rita, also had a fractured skull, broken arm, and pneumonia. The boyfriend who surrendered to there was a boyfriend who surrendered to police, and the mother said she gave the baby a bath and then used a cotton swab to clean his nose because it was itching, and she said she didn't know that the swab had been used to clean a methamphetamine pipe. Most of us get our Q-tips from a sealed package. Now, these privacy rights should be thrown out the window when it comes to cases like this. You have to wonder, Wendy, how many cases come to hospitals, private clinics, whatever, that law enforcement, prosecutors, child's protection don't even hear about.
Yeah, well, I don't even know how to answer that question. It's a hard piece of data to talk about, because really good scientists will tell you, in a sense, you're reporting on the absence of information, right? How do you measure the absence of information? But what I like to talk about is the fact that whatever crude instruments we have to make estimates based on anecdotes and so forth, I think it's fair to say that the underreporting is huge. The underreporting problem is huge. And so, you know, we have two choices. We can say, well, if we're not hearing about it, it's not our public problem. It's not society's problem. Or we can say, the fact that we're not hearing about it is our collective problem, and we have to be more proactive in injecting ourselves into these private spaces. Now, people get very nervous, especially when you think about the Bill of Rights and the Fourth Amendment and privacy rights as a fundamental constitutional principle. Nobody wants to give up fundamental rights willy-nilly, and I'm on board with that. On the other hand, if the Constitution is being used as a shield behind which whole classes of people are suffering grave harm, then, you know, that's not liberty to me. That's not doing anything to protect liberty in any meaningful sense. So when I hear people talk about, well, you know, privacy really matters and the Bill of Rights is more important than even policing the bad stuff that happens in our private homes, I say, doesn't liberty have something to do with the ability of children to live violence-free lives, or, you know, not to be killed with impunity? And because they're so vulnerable, you know, don't we owe them an extra thumb on the scale when it comes to the way we think about how the Bill of Rights should apply as it pertains to their right to live in peace and safety? And where do the children's constitutional interests kick in here? So my concern is that we've always talked, you know, in a constitutional sense about the importance of equal protection of the laws. We've talked about the fact that in a free society, it's job number one of the government to protect the most vulnerable. And, you know, the most vulnerable, who's more vulnerable than kids?
Right.
You know, the problem is, there's a really funny thing about kids. In addition to the fact that they don't vote and they don't have any money, they don't stay kids long enough to develop a political constituency. You know, if they could only all stay 7 for about 100 years, they could develop their political strength in some other way, but they don't. They're a transient special class of people. So one of the things I like about my job is that I get to pound the table. You know, there's something about the power of the media to give people like me the ability to really pound the table. And you know that old saying, if you don't have the facts, argue the law. If you don't have the law, argue the facts. And if you don't have either, pound the table. Kids never have the facts or the law on their side. They, generally speaking, only have protesters and advocates like myself. And good, and that's good. And Bill O'Reilly and yep. Glenn Beck and the people with whom I, you know, do a fair amount of work with, what they do that's wonderful is they bring shame to bear on the institutions that fail kids, and they bring shame to bear on, you know, law enforcement that says, well, we were gonna do something, but we didn't want to violate the parents' privacy rights.
Yeah.
Being a parent is a privilege. Being a parent is also very difficult, and so we have to do a better job both letting parents know that just because they've given birth doesn't mean they have a right to do what they want to their kids. And it also, you know, doesn't mean that they can sort of give birth, go home, and, you know, act like they've just given birth to a slave until
yeah, exactly.
the kid turns 18. You know, I think we also have to encourage parents to reach out for help if they're dysfunctional in some way, so that they don't feel like if they call social services to ask for guidance and how do you bathe a baby. I don't think that's the story in this case, by the way.
No, exactly.
I just don't buy at all that you can accidentally use a Q-tip, you know, dumped in meth to wash your child's nose. Too many parents with serious drug problems really do use their children as props and re-victimize them for entertainment, and it's sick. It's not sick, it's evil. Let me be clear about that.
Yep.
But the point is, we do need more ways of extricating children from violent situations, and including when it happens in the home. And we don't really have the tools because we're stuck. We jerk our Fourth Amendment knees and we jerk our Bill of Rights knees all the time and say, well, we can't do that. We can't do that because freedom would suffer. Actually, you know, freedom would be a better would be better served to these vulnerable people. It's like saying freedom suffers when we have civil rights laws, because in a way that's government power forcing us to care more about each other and not have hatred and violence based on race and gender and ethnicity and so forth. Well, you know, civil rights laws are a form of government power that liberates us. And, you know, so we have to be careful not to overstate that all regulation, all law enforcement, all government force is not necessarily harmful to freedom.
Well said. The book is And Justice for Some. The website is andjusticeforsome.com. Wendy, it's always nice to have you on the program. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks a lot, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. We'll be right back with Lori Maxwell. She is the deputy manager for the Animal Fighting Campaign with the Humane Society of the United States of America. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. There's nothing more disgusting than cruelty to animals. It's been very prevalent lately with the Michael Vick case. I thought it'd be time to bring back someone from the Humane Society of the United States onto the program to talk about that. And tonight we have Lori Maxwell. She is the deputy manager of the Animal Fighting Campaign at the Humane Society of the United States. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you know, we always have heard, you know, the cockfighting, a little bit of dogfighting, but this story, as tragic as it is, the publicity never became greater than when it involved Michael Vick. Sadly, it shouldn't have to take a case like this. This should have been something that was in the news all the time to advise people. What are your thoughts, and what is the Humane Society of the United States doing about this?
Well, we have been doing a lot of things, and honestly, Michael Vick has done us a big favor.
He
has pulled a bigger publicity stunt than we could ever do by ourselves. And
you know, and we're not making, we should clarify, we're not making jest of it, because it's tragic, it's terrible. This guy is a scumbag. I'm saying that. He killed animals, he was using them to fight, but he also brought this huge problem to the forefront, and the media, leave it to the media to ignore things until a celebrity gets involved,
right,
jumped on it, and now a lot of people know about it. Sorry I cut you off there.
No, that's fine. Yeah, my apologies. Absolutely. What I mean to say is Michael Vick is only the tip of the iceberg, and that is really an unfortunate truth in our society right now. The Humane Society of the United States estimates that there are about 40,000 professional or hobbyist dog fighters in the United States, and about 100,000 street dog fighters. Now, these are people that, you know, aren't too serious about it, but they do it, you know, once in a while in a back alley, that sort of thing, but they still do it. And about 250,000 pit bulls are victims of dog fights right now, and there are about a dozen underground publications. This is a very large and very thriving underground criminal system we have working with us right now, and the Humane Society is doing a lot to combat this. We have been working on hundreds of dog fighting cases since the inception of the Humane Society 50 years ago. It's always been a big project of the HSUS is to work on dog fighting. Right now, we have just doubled our reward fund from offering a standing $2,500 reward to a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of a dog fighter. And we are working with law enforcement agencies all over the country to educate them on how to recognize dog fighting. You know, a lot of times police will go on a drug bust, and they will, if they don't know what to look for, they may run across dog fighting evidence and not even notice that it's dog fighting.
Yeah, exactly.
Since the Vick case, since there's been a lot on the news on what all the elements are that goes on in dog fighting, there has been a lot of awareness in the law enforcement world about this crime.
Now, these dogs are trained, raised to fight. What happens to them in an investigation where they are taken, rescued, for lack of a better term? They're not a dog or an animal that can be put back into a home, for example, are they?
Right. No, they're not, and it's very unfortunate, and this is solely at the hands of the dog fighter that this happens. Dog fighters have taken a breed, the pit bull terrier, a breed that is bred for human orientation, loyalty, and courageousness, and they have exploited that to the detriment of this breed, and it's very, very tragic. Once the dog has been fought, they train these dogs by starting them out when they're very young, trying to entice them to fight other dogs by what they call rolling them, short little sessions of seeing how the dog reacts to other dogs, kind of poking it, prodding it. And then when the dog gets older, they will also do things like starve it, beat it, make it agitated, sometimes in some cases even feed it gunpowder to make them mean. And it's very, very tragic. So once a dog has been fought, it's not good for anybody. It's not good for the community. It's not good for other animals. And it's not good for the reputation of the breed for these animals to be put back in a home. It's very tragic, but that's the truth of the matter here.
Are humane societies across North America, law enforcement, you talked about training, law enforcement could go and do a drug search and find dog fighting but not even know what they're looking for. Is there enough government help with something like this? I know that I sound like a broken record when I keep asking that question, but God darn it, you know, we keep seeing millions and billions of dollars spent on things that you scratch your head about when you have a huge problem like this. Is the Humane Society getting enough support from the government?
You know, since the Vick case, we have seen the public outcry about this, and that's one of the best things that has come out of this case, is the public has had a no-tolerance policy for dog fighting, and they're speaking out to their legislators, and that's what we need to happen, because legislators need to take this seriously. They need to realize that this is a problem in our society, and not only is it bad for animals, but you have things like illicit drugs, illicit weapons, and, you know, violence. You know, you have children taken to these things and desensitized to violence. It's bad for communities in general. It's not just an animal issue. It's a community issue. And, you know, there is not enough legislative support. In Wyoming and Idaho, dog fighting is not a felony. It's a felony in 48 states except for those two. And in 26 states, it is a misdemeanor to attend a dog fight. And in the other 24, it's a felony. It's, you know, there's not enough support at all, and we need to crack down on this once and for all.
Well, I find that totally bizarre that two states wouldn't find it as a felony. My next question is the media. Again, we talked a little bit about the media covering this now because of Michael Vick, but what more can the media do?
The media can expose dog fighting for what it really is. They can show people that this is not Michael Vick. He is not isolated in this. He is just a mirror, a reflection, if you will, of the larger picture. And the media can show that, you know, you see a lot of pit bull attacks on TV. The problem there is not necessarily something wrong with the breed, but with the dog fighters and with how these dogs are treated. So the media showing the whole story, covering that, maybe just doing some muckraking about some of these other heroes that are role models in our culture that are also involved in dog fighting, just making the public more aware that this is a huge problem, and, you know, helping the public know what to do and how to recognize a dog fight and how to let their legislators know that they don't want this in their communities anymore.
Some of the pinheads I've seen interviewed on cable news, for example, that come up with the comment, well, it's just a dog. I want to reach through the television screen and shake them and wake them up a little bit, because there's the propensity to violence. And if you can take a dog and hang it in your backyard and kill it or drown it or make it fight, you could do that to a human being too, and there's an equal parallel there. Your thoughts on those, and I'm the one calling them pinheads, but that's exactly what they are when they try to lower this to, well, it's just a dog.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Chicago Police Department recently did a study where they looked at people that have been convicted of animal abuse crimes over a 3-year period, and they found that 65% of those convicted of animal abuse crimes were also convicted of aggravated domestic battery or domestic battery. I mean, the link is just, it's uncanny. There are so many studies out there showing that violence to animals is a precursor to violence to humans. I've seen interviews with young inner city kids that have seen dog fights and just think nothing of it. Think nothing of it, because that's what they are being taught. And when they grow up, the cycle starts all over again. You know, it's not good. Dog fighting is inherently violent, and it festers all these crimes. It's just a horrible, horrible thing. And you're absolutely right. The issues of human violence and animal violence are not that far off.
Well, you know, you guys are kicking butt. You're doing the right thing. We're trying to, this is a society of violence, unfortunately, and when these sorts of things come up, we have to step in and do what we can. Lori Maxwell from the Humane Society of the United States, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, and maybe we'll have you back on again soon.
Thank you so much, and listeners can visit humanesociety.org/animalfighting to find out how they can help.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, that's it. That's the Dana Pretzer Show here tonight. I remind you to go to our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, whatever you want. Leave comments. And, of course, the creme de la creme of blogs on the Internet is scaredmonkeys.com. My name is Dana Pretzer, and I want to thank you and my guests for joining me, because without either one of you, it wouldn't be much of a show. Good night, and we'll see you again next week.